I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Somaya Valley opens her long-awaited Serpentine Pavilion. The UK government's chief architect, Andy von Bradsky, quits. The RIBA's 2021 fellows criticised for a lack of women. And Roger Stoke Harbour and Partners' contentious South Kensington Tube Station overhaul is sent back to the drawing board. My name is Merlin Fulcher, I'm an architectural journalist, and I will be bringing you a roundup of this week's top London architecture news. Welcome to the Lundown. My special guest this week is Sean Adams. Sean is a writer, architectural designer, and co-founder of Poor Collective. Welcome to the show. Our first story is all about the Serpentine Pavilion, which opens this week, a year later than originally planned, and as usual for this prestigious commission, has been reviewed in the AJ, Guardian, and almost universally across the built environment media. This is the 20th Serpentine Pavilion to be erected in London's Kensington Gardens, and it's been designed by Counterspace of Johannesburg, continuing the Serpent Gallery's long-running tradition of inviting new international architectural talents to design their very first work on UK soil. Counterspace is led by the rising star architect Somaya Valley, who will be turning 31 this year, making her the youngest ever designer of the landmark pavilion. This year's installation has been inspired by the architecture and lived experience of immigrant spaces throughout the city. Unusually, it also includes 4 satellite installations at important community cultural hubs in Finsbury Park, Deptford, Notting Hill and Barking, and a new £100,000 annual fellowship programme for artists exploring art, spatial politics and community practice. Counterspace, which has collaborated with the Serpentine on a series of one-off and online research projects throughout the past year, said the themes behind the pavilion have been made even more relevant by the coronavirus pandemic. Valley said, "My practice and this pavilion are centred around amplifying and collaborating with multiple and diverse voices from many different histories, with an interest of themes of identity, community, belonging and gathering." Regular listeners will remember we covered the uproar around the pavilion's foundations last month after 85 cubic metres of concrete were poured into the ground to support the structure. Many architects questioned the potential environmental impact, calling the use of this much concrete, which is a highly carbon-intensive material, disproportionate and excessive. The fact the Serpentine's artistic director, Hans Ulrich Obrist, previously said the gallery would place ecology, quote, at the heart of everything we do, was also highlighted by the critics. In response to this uproar, Valley told AJ this week, "There's no defence for not having an agenda on sustainability or the use of materials. It's actually a carbon negative building," she said, adding, "But this has brought about a conversation, and Hans Ulrich has said to me, all future pavilions will now subscribe to being carbon negative." The Serpentine Pavilion opens this Friday and runs until the 17th of October, after which it will be taken down and reconstructed by Therm Group, a developer and operator of wellbeing resorts, which has acquired the structure for an undisclosed sum. So Sean, what do you think of the pavilion this year? Does it represent a profound cultural shift for this central London pop-up structure, typically associated with swanky summer drinks parties and with abstract high architecture, to instead be spotlighting and reflecting the lived experience of London's migrant communities, whose very community spaces often occupy the fringes of society and are frequently threatened with redevelopment? Has the architects succeeded in your view, or with the high society magazine Tatler declaring the pavilion, quote, this summer's cultural hotspot, is the pavilion still ultimately just a bougie setting for canapes and Prosecco?
I think the pavilion like represents a powerful shift in the Serpentine's kind of annual celebration of international architecture, because I think in the past when I've gone to the Serpentine pavilion, I've not really thought, well, this is standing out or this is promoting or platforming a particular agenda. I think I'm kind of going there, I'm like, oh, I mean, this is quite cool. I've never seen this architect build anything over in the UK before. And then after 5 minutes, I've kind of left. And I haven't been really moved in the same way that I think that the later Serpentine Pavilion really will move me. And I think what is really important about this one is the fact that it's looking at the migrant communities and how they've contributed and given them a platform. I mean, the fact that it's one of five pieces that are going to be spread throughout the city, I think that's quite powerful, and it speaks to this consciousness about these migrant communities, because I think we've seen it over the last few years that these kind of communities are just getting pushed to the periphery. No one seems to care about them, and their voices are kind of going unheard. And I think now is the time to really bring these voices to the center stage. And I think just the perfect time to have these conversations.
So I'm just thinking, for more than two decades, the Serpentine Pavilion has brought new international architectural talents to London to deliver their very first ever UK work in front of a huge and admiring audience. It's helped raise the profile of architecture as a rival to the art world, but it's also helped boost the careers of many great names, including Zaha Hadid, Daniel Libeskind and Sana. But with the selection of a non-architect, the US urban planner turned artist Theaster Gates to design the 2022 installation, next year's installation. Is the Serpentine Pavilion Commission now at a crossroads? And if change is coming, how are you hoping the commission evolves so it can deliver what societies really need from architecture in the future?
What is super interesting about this is that, like, whilst they've spoken about communities and bringing people together, like, what architect has really done that in the Serpentine Pavilion? I mean, Francis Kerry, I think he did a good job in doing that when his pavilion was looking at the tree and communities in Western Africa. But outside of that, I don't know if I would say that the architecture of the pavilion are actually bringing communities together. I think they're more still quite egotistical statements like, okay, I'm this famous architect and I'm going to put my statement and leave my mark here. Because I think a lot of people are going to look at the pavilion and think, well, this is for a completely different class. I mean, myself, coming from a working class background, I couldn't really tell you any people from around my area that is travelling all the way there to see the pavilion. And I think that kind of says a lot, because it's the kind of people that and their agenda that are attracting people to actually come. And I think if you have an artist, a kind of urban planner whose kind of narratives and stories kind of centre on people that are often on the kind of periphery of society, I mean, that's going to bring and attract a whole new audience. So I think in a way it's kind of better. And we're increasingly seeing that a lot of the people in the UK that are doing architecture without a capital A, they aren't necessarily architects. Some of the kind of most interesting works that we're seeing are maybe people that have dabbled within the world of architecture, but it's usually the people that aren't even architects that are making the most difference and really care about communities, really care about making a difference, really care about, like, what does design say to the world, instead of kind of just designing something that you can kind of swatter around with canapes and glasses of champagne.
What sort of changes do you think the Serpentine Gallery should be making potentially to the brief and the delivery programme to make sure that excessive structural solutions like this could be avoided in the future? Samai Valley said that carbon negative is going to be a requirement in the future. Is that enough? And also, writing in The Guardian, Ollie Wainwright, he asked how on earth this happened, and he was told that one of the requirements from the Royal Parks, who run the gardens, is that the lawn has to be returned back to its original condition as a sort of pristine lawn. Is there a kind of design solution that you could imagine that would allow a pavilion to sit on top of the lawn without ever disturbing it?
To me, the first thing that comes to mind is, why isn't there just permanent footings that are created and left there? And they do not need to be made from concrete. Why couldn't these footings be here? And within the brief, it says, okay, you're able to design a pavilion. However, you need to make sure that the footings are here, and you need to make sure that you kind of abide by this so that it can actually be structurally sound. And I think for me, that seemed like a no-brainer, because the pavilion is there for several months. So if you were to have footings that are there forever, then like, we won't be having this problem of, okay, now we need to pour concrete and like have the concrete when we're kind of trying to say that ecology is at the center of everything that we do. So I think that's the kind of first thing that I would say. I think in terms of the pristine lawn, I mean, we need to be thinking, what is more important here? Is keeping the lawn pristine the most important thing, or is it actually about given a platform to people? And I'm sure the lawn, there's other parts of the lawn that can still look fine. And I'm sure that's not really a big excuse to me. I think that is not enough for me to not want to just have permanent footings. I think really and truly the permanent footings has to be the thing that they do next, because otherwise you're going to continuously have this problem.
You are listening to The Lundown, a weekly news show brought to you by Open City. We rely on support from people like you to make this show. So if you like The Lundown and want to support our work, please share the link, leave us a review on iTunes, and consider becoming an Open City friend. Open City friends receive a bunch of perks, including discounts on all Open City events and publications, audio walking tours of amazing parts of London, and friends events at special locations around the city. Visit open-city.org.uk/support to find out more. Our next story this week was covered in the AJ and has created ripples through the built environment media. The government's chief architect, Andy von Bradsky, is to step down next month after 2 years in the position. In the £61,000 a year role, von Bradsky was tasked with improving the design quality of new housing developments in the UK. This was to be done by raising awareness, improving policy and official guidance. During his tenure, von Bradsky worked on the National Design Guide, the National Model Design Code, and other design-related initiatives such as the Home of 2030 competition, won by Newcastle-based Mawson Kerr and Open Studio. Coinciding with his time as chief architect, we also saw the controversial expansion of permitted development rights, which critics say has allowed developers to swerve planning permission and erect slum housing. So, Sean, who is Andy von Bradsky, and what has he achieved as the government's chief architect? For a long time, the UK, unlike other countries around the world, had no chief architect, despite having a chief medic, a chief scientist, and other chief advisors that we now see on TV quite a lot. Has the creation of this role, with von Bradsky as its first incumbent, led to real progress on housing, design, and delivery, or are we still facing as much of a crisis now as we did back in 2019 when he was hired?
So Andy von Bradsky is the former head of architecture at the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. But what is kind of interesting about this role is the fact that, like, he's the first person in around 15 years to serve as a government chief architect. I mean, like you kind of mentioned before, like, there's so many different sectors that have chiefs. So I think it's quite clear that there's a kind of issue already with how the government kind of looks at architects and how relevant they actually are in policy making. If we look at what he's kind of done in the last 2 years, he's kind of like, his role has been working on the government's response to the Grenfell Tower tragedy, looking at the National Model for Design Code. But then again, when we think about these design codes, we also got to think, are they doing what they're kind of set out to do, or are they doing more damage? Because in a way, sometimes we look at them and we think, okay, they set out a clear framework of housing standards, But then for the majority of the time, it's like, well, developers are looking at this as this is the bare minimum. So we need to make sure we tick this box. There's no kind of looking at these guides and thinking, you know what? What are ambitions beyond this? Can we add more square meters to these spaces that we're creating? Can we create more kind of livable spaces? No. I mean, a lot of the time it's kind of like we look at these numbers and how do we get these numbers to kind of work out? And I think, in a way, a lot of people didn't actually know he was the chief architect. And I think that's another massive problem. Like, the fact that when it comes to housing, like, architects are talking about housing within the sector. But then when we talk about policy, it feels as if, like, these same architects aren't transitioning over and making these kind of, writing these policies and kind of flagging up all of these issues, because it's the architects that day-to-day are actually dealing with these codes. However, it's the other people in policy that are writing them. And I feel like there's a clear disconnect between the two. And I think there really needs to be someone that genuinely cares about creating housing for the kind of most marginalized and unheard people. Because I think, in a way, it's those people that are kind of getting kicked in the teeth repeatedly every time we kind of revise these design codes. Over the 2 years, I don't know how much I would say that he's really done, but he has kind of set the foundation for someone else to pick up some of his work. But I think a lot of the kind of statements that got thrown around about, like, amplifying the voices of local residents, I'm yet to really see that. And I think it takes long term change to allow this to happen. And I think within 2 years, you can't really say get local voices heard. Like, it's really impossible. We need someone in a position that really cares for a significant amount of time.
I mean, it certainly sounds like quite a hard job, because, you know, while he was there as officially the chief architect, you had a government which earlier this year basically announced a controversial plans to expand permitted development rights. And effectively what that does is it allows many unused commercial buildings, such as shops, gyms, restaurants and banks, to be converted into housing without planning permission. I mean, that's exactly what an architect does. They get the planning permission. So it seems like, you know, he's the chief architect. They're just going ahead and kind of pulling the rug out from under his feet with that policy. It's a move which many fear may leave the gates wide open to unscrupulous developers to create the slums of the future. Now, similar to what you said, some commentators have remarked that von Bradsky, despite his high salary and significant remit, was largely absent figure from architecture culture, or rarely seen outside a kind of small bubble of industry and political events. You know, in fact, when news broke of Bradsky's resignation, the Financial Times architecture critic Edwin Heathcote, he tweeted, quote, "There was a government head of architecture? Who knew?" Yeah, that was his response. But obviously, it's still unknown who'll be taking over from Bradsky. The job's going to be advertised, Sean. Could be one for you. You know, what would you like to see from his successor? You know, should the government's head of architecture be more present in the industry? Or is it okay for civil servants to just quietly work behind the scenes? You know, what kind of architect would you like to see take on this kind of prestigious role?
When it comes to things like housing, and when you're talking about, like, local residents who are kind of suffering and seem to be at the brunt of the housing industry, like, you need to be amongst these people. You need to be at these events. You need to be, like, approachable. So I think for the next person, it needs to be someone that everyone in the industry knows. It needs to be someone that's actively commenting, actively kind of going against the grain and standing up for residents. Because I think it is difficult. Of course it's difficult. As an architect and a designer, you kind of want to get your proposal across the line. And sometimes it's difficult kind of sympathizing with the residents when you're kind of thinking of the success of your own business. But there's endless amounts of architects that are kind of always on Twitter just showing you the housing standards and bashing them. And we all know a few that are doing that. And I think those are the kind of people that genuinely want to see change. I think those are the people that we always see at the events. We always see going to the tours. We always see putting their hand up and asking the awkward questions that no one wants to say, but it's really the elephant in the room. And I think that kind of humility and understanding and kind of being on the ground and kind of working with these kind of local residents, with these local communities, that is really what you need. You need an architect that is here for the people. And I think it's weird because when I think of architect, I think of that being the person that kind of designs buildings for others. But a lot of the time, it doesn't necessarily feel that, or it doesn't feel that way, because the people that are writing these policies have never lived in the types of houses that they're designing. So in a way, you kind of want someone that has lived experiences, so they know, you know what, when they're looking at these policies, how could anyone ever live like this? Because if you're so far removed from these environments, you're looking at the policy and thinking, yeah, I mean, that looks about right. Like, and I think we need someone that really understands, who's lived in poor housing and like speaks to all of these locals and doesn't make these kind of sweeping statements of, okay, I'm going to do this. Like, we need kind of less talking and more action. And I think that's kind of what it boils down to. Like, I would prefer to see what you've done instead of you kind of just saying what you propose to do and nothing happens and you kind of, next thing you know, you've kind of left your role.
Well, you've won me over. If it was up to me, you'd have the job. Our third story this week was covered in the Architects Journal, the AJ, and it's all to do with the controversial redevelopment of South Kensington Underground Station. Roger Sturck Harbour and Partners has been sent back to the drawing board to once again revise its designs for a development above the station, just 5 months after it submitted fine-tuned plans for the site. The Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea's planning committee had been due to finally rule on the application for 50 homes and commercial space around the station on the 3rd of June, but this has now been delayed until further notice. The designs, drawn up alongside Julian Harrop Architects for Native Land and TfL, have been tipped for approval despite opposition from 1,900 residents, 22 local groups and 5 local councillors, as well as the area's MP. The deferral of the planning committee ruling comes after Native Land and TfL requested extra time to make last-minute amendments to the designs. This is reported to have included a height reduction and setback of several buildings and reduced glazing on the top levels of the bullnose building proposed over South Kensington Station itself. The latest tweaks will then be subject to yet another round of consultation on top of the consultation for the amendments which were already submitted back in January. Trustees from the Onslow Neighbourhood Association, who campaigned against RSHP's designs, have voiced their disappointment over the January revisions, stating the changes were purely cosmetic and once more ignored their local feedback. So Sean, what's this all about? Much of the pushback against this development centres around aesthetic points. Many people opposing the plans are concerned that the contemporary designs are, quote, inappropriate for the local area and would fail to preserve the character of South Ken. Certainly, the station has a huge amount of personality, you know, with that gorgeous arcade as you leave the station. And, you know, someone who's an RCA graduate and was very much a local, what do you think about these designs? Are they complementary to the historic nature of the station and its surroundings? Or are they destroying this gem of Bohemia?
I think when you have like over 1,500 objections from local residents, I think it says a lot about the scheme in itself. And I think in a way, the original scheme just kind of looked like a behemoth, like that you would see from quite a while away. Like you'll be quite far away and you'll be able to still see it. So I think the problem there was that it wasn't in keeping with the kind of local architecture. And I think the height, the amount of glazing, I think the use of material before they kind of chained it to the stone, like, because it is on a prominent corner as well, I think it just kind of stood out like a sore thumb a little bit. And I think the residents must have just been thinking the same thing. And I think especially the fact that if you think about Exhibition Road and all of the architecture along that road, like, I don't think the residents really want the station to be the kind of highlight of that area.
Our final story this week was covered in the AJ and centres around calls for the RIBA to reform its fellowship programme after failing to appoint any women or non-binary people in 2021. The fellowship scheme sees RIBA chartered members nominate themselves for fellowships and, if appointed, they pay 20% higher membership fees. This is distinct from the honorary fellows who are appointed due to being ambassadors for the profession and the RIBA community. But the scheme has come under fire for its lack of gender diversity, with just 10 of the 70 existing RIBA fellow members being women and none being non-binary. The current concept and process is clearly not working in terms of equity. That's what has been said by Fionn Stevenson, Professor of Sustainable Development at Sheffield University. Christina Cerulli, Associate Professor in Community-Led Architecture and Urban Design at Sheffield Hallam University and a former RIBA Commissioner for Ethics, agreed. She said, this fellowship, quote, most definitely needs a fundamental rethink. Cerulli suggested dropping extra fees for fellows, as well as instigating a quota system, ensuring new fellows better reflect the membership of the RIBA. So, Sean, an all-male cohort for 2021 isn't a good look for the RIBA, who recently appointed a new head of diversity on an £80,000 salary. Isn't this exactly the sort of blunder the head of diversity should be able to prevent happening?
This is crazy. In 2021, we're having an all-male cohort. I mean, like, over the last year, I think with everything that's happened, like, you should have looked at this cohort and known that this is just kind of unacceptable. Because I think a lot of people's criticism is that, maybe they didn't feel confident in kind of applying, or maybe, I read that people were saying that maybe more men are more confident in applying. But then that's the problem. That is the problem. That's where the problem lies. If men are happy to apply and everyone else isn't, then there's a problem, and there needs to be a strategy in place where it attracts everyone. Because I think when you create a welcoming kind of framework for things, that's when this kind of diversity will come through. And I think it's getting to a point now where it's getting so ridiculous that, like, no one would ever want to say, you know what, we need to set two spaces aside for this kind of person or this kind of person. But that's how it is looking like how it's going to be. Because I was reading on the AJ that it said that out of the 70 fellows, only 10 of them are women. And then the article went on to say there's more fellows called John, Richard, David or Dave than women. That is crazy. Like, that is absolutely crazy. Like, when you start to think about these things and like critically, you're thinking there is definitely something wrong going on here. There's a real issue. Like, if the fellows are the ones that are we're kind of celebrating and platforming, we can't be looking through the fellows and seeing the same kind of people. We need to be seeing a diverse range of people, and that's diversity in every single sense. And I think if in 2021 we're looking and we're seeing people that all look the same, there is a real problem. I mean, next year, really and truly, they might just have to just say, you know what, there can't be any men next year. Like, we need to have an all kind of non-men cohort. And I think anyone that really, really cares about inclusion and diversity will be happy with that. Because I think we really need to start, these scales are not weighted. We need to really start elevating people, because there's more than enough non-binary or female people that we can celebrate. I think no one can argue that there isn't. So why aren't we doing it?
Christina Cerulli, she suggested, like you said, bringing in quotas for fellows in the future. But looking at the bigger picture, are quotas in themselves enough, or does it risk becoming a kind of box-ticking exercise that in itself fails to address those root causes of the lack of diversity in architecture? Certainly this same approach, is it something that some people have witnessed negative impacts in other fields? For example, procurement, where some practitioners who are from diverse backgrounds have also reported being used for their names on bids, but then cynically not valued for their contribution to the actual project itself they're trying to win. How do we go beyond the quotas and actually make the real difference?
I think there's two issues here. I mean, firstly, if we're having this same problem year in, year out, as much as I think quotas could turn into a tick box exercise, we're going to have to need some kind of quota, because we need to formalize this. Like, we can't keep saying, you know what, well, there's no women or non-binary people that have applied, or like the quality of these people are higher. Like, no, like because these people bring completely different viewpoints. And I think if this keeps happening, we're going to have a quota. However, the issue with the quota is, like you said, that you now have these people in these positions, but their voices aren't really being amplified, or they're kind of getting brushed to the side because, okay, we've got them in here, but now we don't need to actually do anything. But then I think the next step is to challenge what happens. Because in a way, like, if we were to, these diverse practices, you're right, their names on things, but then they're kind of like, what are they actually doing? And I think, in a way, there might have to be, in the interim, we start to see after a few months, okay, so you've now got these non-binary fellows, you've also got these female fellows, so what are they doing within the organisation? Because we need to start, we need to actually start chasing people and seeing what they're doing, because I think it's not enough to simply just say, you know what, we've got them now, and like, now that's enough. I think we need to be seeing the impact and the roles that they're playing, otherwise, there's no point in them even having the fellows at all. Like, really and truly, if we really want to have voices amplified, we need to see what processes you have in place to allow this to actually happen.
And of course, as we know, genuine diversity is not just about gender, but about many identities and their interrelationship. So that's race, class, wealth, immigration status, language, physical abilities, family connection, sexuality, and so on. Given such an enormously complex intersecting web of identities, how do we navigate the critical challenge of creating an industry that's genuinely diverse?
I think, again, it goes back to, if you create a welcoming and inviting space, then I generally think the diversity and the kind of inclusive environment will follow. Because if you don't have that environment, then who is going to want to sign up or be a part of your organization? Like, if you're looking, because I think there's another thing, like, we should really be able to see how many of each kind of gender or sexuality or religion is signing up for these kind of like to be a fellow in all kind of whether it's like architectural awards or kind of titles, so then we can see who is actually being attracted. Because if you were to look at who's being attracted, then you can see maybe they're only picking all of these men because there's only men applying. And then there's a problem. That's the problem. Like, there needs to be some critical reflection, instead of trying, like, every year just going on and, like, moving ahead with things, instead of looking at your own organization. I think that's the hardest thing for many organizations, is looking inside and seeing where is the actual issue. When there's a real desire and passion and genuine kind of voices come into the forefront and wanted to make a change, it can happen. So I think, in a way, like, if they really want to be inclusive and diverse, then next year we're gonna see it. And if we don't see it next year, then that says it all.
Fantastic. Sean, it's been a great pleasure to feature you on The Lundown this week. Where can our listeners keep up to speed on all the exciting things you're doing? Where should they look to read about your work and hear what you're saying?
So you can follow me on Instagram. So I think that's _Sean, Shawn _Adams, Adams _. And follow Poor Collective at POOR_Collective.
Awesome. Thanks very much for being on the show. I hope we can feature you again in the future.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Lundown, a show from Open City, rounding up the big stories in architecture and the built environment each week in London. If you've enjoyed the show and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to The Architect's Journal, which has covered all these issues and many more too. You can find the show on Twitter or Instagram at @OpenCityLondon, or by using the hashtag Lundown, LNDDWN. Open City receives no public funding, so if you want to support our work, please go to open-city.org.uk/support and sign up as an Open City friend. Open City is dedicated to making London a more open, accessible, and and equitable city.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.